Welcome to the New Jersey Bank Marketing Association podcast. In this program, we're pleased to present highlights from the 2018 Economic Outlook meeting held December 7th, 2017 at the Holiday Inn Express in Clark, New Jersey. We'll begin our program right after this message from our sponsor, the book, The Business of Podcasting.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Hi, I'm Steve Lubetkin, your podcast host for this program. This podcast contains short highlights from each of the speakers at this year's Economic Outlook, produced by the New Jersey Bank Marketing Association. If you enjoy these highlights, we invite you to visit statebroadcastnews.com, our podcast production partner, where you can purchase audio podcasts of the complete presentations by our speaker. You can purchase individual podcasts, or you can get the entire set of three presentations for an immediate digital download. Our first speaker at the Economic Outlook was Larry Cohen, Director of Strategic Business Insights Consumer Financial Decisions. Since 1985, Larry has focused exclusively on the financial services area, providing analysis of and insights into strategic planning, marketing, product design, market research, macroeconomics, and competitive intelligence. As director of the CFD Group, Larry manages and markets all related syndicated research programs. He also manages comprehensive survey research methodology, including sampling, data collection, field supervision, cleaning data processing, analysis and presentation of results, multivariate statistical analysis, and marketing of consumer survey research, covering an exhaustive range of services, products, and topics. Here's an excerpt of Larry's presentation.
So now we get into some fun stuff. I'm going to talk about four mega trends. The pyramid to the rectangle, a train coming, no stopping it. And forgive me, money, 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 money. Okay, that's about all the singing you'll get. And it's the circle of life's needs. Let's talk about them one by one. That's the pyramid to the rectangle. And the bad news or good news, depending on your point of view, is you really can't fight demographics. Demographics are as inevitable as the fact that every 365 days you get a year older. So again, some of the implication, less focus on youth, there's less youth to focus on, more focus on all ages. Now, I don't think we're going to suddenly become focus just on old people. The boomers like to believe that, but it won't happen. But there'll be a more even distribution, perhaps even more focus on individual stages than ages. The boomers are likely to live longer and healthier lives, but then so will the Gen Xers, and the millennials even more so. And a lot of our assumptions are based on people living shorter lives. A lot of the products and services and a lot of the way society is set up is expecting people to retire at age 60. And this is the new life stages will evolve. I mean, at the turn of the last century, you lived an average of 50 years, which is barely enough time to have grandchildren. Now, if you're living an average of 80 years, you can have grandchildren and you can have great-grandchildren. Or you could choose not to have children when you're 19. And a lot of people are choosing that because you now can actually make that choice, at least for the time being. And that means that you'll have people having children at ages from 18 up to 50. And maybe more, I don't know. But that means a lot of the needs that we used to associate with having a first child won't happen when they're 18 and 19. It'll happen when they have that first child at 30 or 40. I didn't start having children until I was in my 40s. Right. The other thing is this shifting of the life stages around the life path. Okay? serial parenting was the joke I think I used last time. You know, you have one set of children, then you get remarried, you have a second set of children. Okay, you could do that, and I know people that are doing that, and they're very sad. But it's there was a guy that worked at the Department of Treasury. I met him for lunch in D.C. once, and he looked at me and he goes, "Well, I did it." You go, "What did you do?" He said, "I just had twins." 55. He just had twins. I think he's still at the Department of the Treasury. The other part of this to keep in mind is that top end of the pyramid, we didn't have life stages for those ages, okay? And there are going to be a lot of boomers, 76, 79 million of them, who are going into those life stages now. And if you think they're going to just sit around 5 years playing canasta shuffleboard and moving to Florida, no. Florida won't be there. It's going to melt. I mean, be underwater. Again, please ignore all my political comments. So there's the other thing that's happening, and this was from my earlier presentation. Let's say you have a divorce rate of X when people live to be 50 years old. Now they live to be 80 years old. I can't imagine that X becomes X minus a certain number of years. It's more. But then you get people who are marrying in again and marrying of different ages and different types of backgrounds. And we start seeing maybe we're going to go back to the three-generation household again. Or maybe the whole community becomes one family. I don't think there are many Mormons in New Jersey, but I could be wrong. Anyway, the whole idea here is that your products and services are based on an idea of a nuclear structure that is antiquated moving into the future. And so you have to think about those products and services from the vantage point of the new way people are actually structuring their households. I mean, one of the things I love about New Jersey is we have the greatest amount of diversity in this state of any state in the country. I mean, there are other states that have higher numbers of minorities, but they don't have as many different types. We've got them all. They all wind up in New Jersey. And they all bring with them a lot of their own cultures and a lot of their own associations with community groups and things like that. These structures become dominant on a national basis after this goes throughout the country. But right now, New Jersey is sort of an experimental area in terms of what the world or what the country will look like as more communities become more diverse. So we're ahead of this curve and we're experiencing this today. I think our experiences will actually serve to help inform how other financial institutions adopt and adapt. So the financial services we have are based on a shorter life path, but the services are the tools with which we build our lives. So there are new, different, and increased challenges for consumers, and of course for the financial providers, manufacturers, distributors, advisors, everybody. So we're becoming more diverse. Women are in control more of transactions. They always were big on the transaction, but also protection, credit, and retirement. They have their own money. I know that sounds sexist. I don't know how to say this without sounding sexist. I'll have to think about that. Because if you start saying, well, they're just people, that's demeaning. They influence financial decisions throughout the life path. Okay? And we need to adjust the processes and the products to take into account that they do have a different perspective on things and that their perspective is as relevant as any other perspective. In fact, it's not a question of the gender of the person. It has to do with that type of approach. If you're a type of person who wants to take risk, doesn't matter what your gender is, you're going to be a risk taker. If you're the type of person safe and secure it is. I mean, much like diversity, which ultimately increases the amount of intermarriage and eventually we're all a different colored shade of not white or black, gender diversity similarly suggests that it's not relevant to a lot of the decisions people make for life. I know, I'm going way out on that limb again. So in 2017, this year, 74 million boomers, the first group of them, started taking required minimum distributions. But there are 80 million millennials. You know, we have spent a long time. The boomers used to not get any respect. This was like, don't trust anybody over 30. You can read it in your history books. But the millennials are struggling today with things that the boomers never had to face. The unions that helped a lot of boomers get entry-level jobs that paid reasonable wages for all intents and purposes outside of the government, they're gone. There is the issue of if people don't leave jobs, there's no room for advancement. There are issues associated with the turnover at jobs. I mean, it's not the same world that boomers faced. It's difficult to overcome when you, you used to say that when you graduated in college or high school and started working, if that was a bad year in the economy, your lifetime earnings would be affected. You would never catch up if you were born in the middle of a recession. Okay, so we may not be in a recession right now, but imagine that when you graduate, you have $100,000 in debt. That's almost as bad as a personal recession. You're not going to be able to overcome that. So the things that you need to do where you need leverage or you need assets, like buy a house or a car or have children, whether or not you get married is another question, becomes that much more difficult. And that's part of the reason that we're in a growth period, but there's a lot of people that don't feel like it's a good time for them. 80 million. The other thing I would love to say, isn't it time we stopped talking about millennials as a group and started looking at some of the subsegments within the millennials and started marketing to them separately? 80 million is a big number. So I would just say it's time to start looking under the hood. So boomers could have 20 or 30 or even more years in retirement from right now. I'm hoping for it. Except I'm never going to retire. Millennials will have at least 30 years until retirement, okay? A lot of our preconceived notions about the life path need to be questioned. And, get back to my theme, financial products are the tools with which we build our lives. If those basic ideas of how we build our lives change, then the tools need to change.
Our second speaker was Doug Kennedy, President and CEO of PPAC Gladstone Bank. As president, Doug is responsible for formulating and executing the bank's overall strategic vision. He leads the company's wealth, lending, and deposit businesses that constitute PPAC Gladstone's boutique private banking approach to banking. He's a proven leader with more than 38 years of commercial banking experience. He served as president of the New Jersey market for Capital One Bank and was responsible for commercial banking activities in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. Over the years, he's held key executive-level positions and had great success building formidable regional and national specialty banking businesses at Fleet Bank, Summit Bank Corp., and Bank of America. Doug's numerous awards include being named to the NJBiz Power 50 Banking List and CEO of the Year by Corporate Live Wire as part of its Innovation and Excellence Awards. Doug spoke about the progress that PPAC Gladstone Bank has been making.
I started out as a teller, where I worked for 2 years behind the teller window. And how many people here were tellers? Okay, I was a lousy teller. That's the reason why I became CEO. When I went into the bank, there was this beautiful woman, because you know, you can't leave the bank until everybody balances, right? Every night, they'd say, how much is Doug off? You know, because they knew I was gonna be off. And so this beautiful lady would come over and push me out of the way. She'd bang, bang, bang like this. Said, here you go, rip off the tape and hand it, and we balanced. So after about a week or so of this, me being a very smart guy, I went home to my brother and I said, I met the woman I'm gonna marry. He goes, does she know you wanna marry her? Have you even dated her? I said, no, but I'm gonna marry her. She's beautiful, she's smart. What else do I need to know? We're married 38 and a half years, have three wonderful children, and I have three grandchildren. So how does this all come into the cash register? You can see our fee income is up 15%. It'll be up with the most recent acquisition and the one we're actually have another one that's right now in due diligence. You know, we have grown that business from about $11 million in revenue to a year. We are now tracking at just north of $30 million. We've got some other acquisitions. By the end of next year, we should be tracking somewhere around $45 to $50 million in revenue, up from $10 million 5 years ago. You can see the assets in administration, we're at 5.2 today. It gives us, you know, I talked about having a diversified revenue source and how that plays into risk management. You know, we've got some multifamily loans, which historically have been very low loss. We've gone into sort of essential equipment, which are assets that we, in the leasing business, that the business can't run without it, has also very good credit metrics to it. And then, of course, the wealth business. So risk is always at the bottom of everything that we do. You can see our loan growth has grown at sort of a 28% annualized rate. Our deposits are growing at 20% on an organic basis. Our branches, I talked about that. The average in New Jersey is about 89 million. We were at 66 million. When I was interviewing, I knew it was about 80 million at the time too. The board said, you know, we have the cheapest cost of funds of any bank in the state. And I said, you're wrong. He said, that's outrageous. I said, if you take all of the expenses of running those branches and laid that on top of your interest costs, and then looked at your true cost of deposits, because you're running at 25% under where the market is, you're actually one of the higher cost of funding. So for us, you know, we're sort of on par in terms of the coupon, but our volumes are running at about 183 million. Our operating efficiency, here's our loans. Again, we've gone from 3.9 million to just under $10 million in loans per employee. We will get north of 10 million. Our efficiency ratio, we're running at about 57 and change right now, down from 77 when we started. Our net income per employee has gone from 28,000 to 92,000 employee. Our income on a year-over-year basis, year-to-date, is up 36%. If you look at our diluted earnings per share, they're up 26%. Our return on equity is now approaching 10%, which was the destination that we wanted. We've actually taken and grown our capital at the same time. Our return on assets is just at 86. You take the deals that we're buying right now, just to show you the math, the inside math, we're issuing debt at a coupon of 4.75. At the current tax rate, the effective cost of that money after taxes is just shy of 3%. The term sheet that we issued this week to buy another wealth firm, and they're all modeling out to this, is 16.5%. So we're borrowing money at 3, we're creating intangible, we're using sub-debt at the holding company, and we're buying a business that has a real rate of return to us north of 13%. You can't get that in the lending business. You can't get that in the lending business. So as we continue to execute on the strategy, the expectation is we're going to be taking some of our thinner spread loans, the multifamily, which has got about a 7% ROE. We're building up a 14% ROE business on the C&I side. We've got this wonderful wealth business that's an overlay, and we will get to destination returns 3 to 5 years out that will be very compelling.
Rounding out our program with a look at the political landscape was Paul Mulshine, opinion columnist for the Star-Ledger. Paul began his journalism career at the student newspaper of Livingston College at Rutgers, the state university, and in 1975 he accepted his first professional job as a reporter for the Ocean County Observer in Toms River, New Jersey. There he covered county and state politics before moving to the Delaware County Times in suburban Philadelphia, where he was named city editor. Paul was later a copy editor on the overnight desk of the Philadelphia Daily News, where he experienced the pleasure of correcting bad prose at 5 o'clock every morning until that stopped being fun. In 1995, he moved to the Star-Ledger, and of late, Paul has attained the distinction of being the only pundit at a major newspaper who saw Donald Trump's victory coming in 2016. His insights and opinions about the current state and future of New Jersey are appreciated by many Star-Ledger readers. Some insights into the political landscape now from Paul Mulshine.
There's bad news both on the state and national level, I would say. Yesterday, Christie had a press conference. He was talking about the, what is it? It's so ridiculous, $180 billion liability for the pension fund. I think all of $80 billion of it's not covered. There's no way to cover it. Murphy's inheriting that. So that's a very bad picture. And then, of course, Murphy, I don't think he's going to have a really tough time keeping his promises, finding money. You know, he has to find, say, $2.5 billion a year just for that pension fund if he wants to bring it up. The entire budget's only $34 billion, so you can't possibly find $2 billion. So he's got a real problem. Then on the national side, I've been following the tax reform quite closely. And And you know, I predict, if it goes through, I predict a disaster because whenever you do something where the people who are negatively affected know it, but the people who are positively affected don't know it, the people who are negatively affected scream, but the people who are positively affected just sort of take it in stride. You know, if somebody gets, say, a $2,000 cut in their income tax, that's like, okay, but then somebody loses, for example, there's a piece in the Journal the other day about this guy is co-director of the American Enterprise Institute Center on Housing. And he's talking all about to spur ownership, home ownership, stop subsidizing it. And he basically says that all of the current subsidies increase the price of your home, which is true. You know, the current income tax subsidies do increase the price of homes because people say now I can spend more because I'm going to get to write off, you know, I'm going to get a $8,000 income tax cut next year if I buy this, you know, $750,000 house. The problem is when you remove all those subsidies and all those prices drop at once, you can imagine in New Jersey, for example, I was talking to a guy I know down at the shore, and he was talking about selling his home in Essex Fells. And, you know, and he's already got a house at the shore. And I said, well, basically sell it quick, because if you look at the typical house in Essex Fells, it's going to cost $1.25 million. It's got a property tax bill of $25,000, right? You do the math on that. You've got a mortgage of, you know, you're more than $2,000 a month just in property taxes. Your mortgage is another $4,000 a month. And, you know, so you're at $6,000 a month where, if you bought this house, right, where you got to deduct at least most of that $6,000, so you probably got a third of it back. I'm sorry, $6,000. Yeah, you probably got $2,000 back a month on it, so you're only paying $4,000. Now, everyone gets the same benefit, which is going to be $24,400, regardless of whether you live in Essex Fells or you live in Nebraska. You know, you can make $30,000 and live in Nebraska. You get the same housing write-off as somebody who buys a million-dollar house in North Jersey. That's got to kill the housing market. The only thing that will be good for, there's one thing it'll be good for. If they start legalizing marijuana, that will work because you're not allowed to put marijuana funds through the federal bank, right? You're not allowed to, California and Colorado and Washington State are having this problem. They collect a whole lot of cash, but you're not allowed to put it into the federal banking system because it violates federal law. So the funny thing is, if he created this state bank, it could actually work for, you know, for pot, but it wouldn't work for anything else, you know? It's just a crazy idea. I mean, I don't know what he's thinking about. You know, it's one of these things where, you know, oh, we'll take the pension money and we'll invest it in the inner cities. And you're like, oh man, you know, that's not gonna work.
We hope you enjoyed these highlights from the New Jersey Bank Marketing Association's 2018 Economic Outlook Program. Now don't forget, if you'd like to purchase audio podcasts of the complete presentations by these speakers, please visit statebroadcastnews.com and you'll be able to purchase digital files for immediate download. If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, you can write to me. The email address is steve@lubetkincommunications.com. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts. It's one of the divisions of our Lubetkin Media Companies. We're headquartered in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and we're on the web at beingthemedia.com. Now, don't forget, if you want to get those complete programs from this seminar, you can go to statebroadcastnews.com and you'll see a link where you can order and download immediately the complete digital audio files of these presentations. For everyone at the New Jersey Bank Marketing Association, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.